Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
阅读、科技、旅行，生活可以很大。对话设计、学习、思考不嫌太多。这里是 iTunes 获奖播客《狗熊有话说》，一听就停不下来的哦。Hello， 你好，这里是独立知识型脱口秀《狗熊有话说》（Bear Talk）， 我是大狗熊。最近，大狗熊采访了很多在新西兰或者是在其他国家一些比较活跃的设计师和一些企业的这个运营者，甚至是一些图书的作者。那么这也是我最近在做的一些新的尝试，就是尽量以英语为母语的。这个活跃的行业人士进行交流，所以这期节目也是同样的一个有趣的话题。那么这期节目呢，我和在新西兰创业十多年的一位其实年纪比我小啊的一位企业老板，叫做 Braden Jarvis， 做了一期有趣的对话节目。那么这期节目里面呢，我们聊了他的关于设计方面的一些见解心得，然后呢也关于用户体验，也关于新西兰如何面对创新等等，进行了一些很有趣的一些交流。这里因为是中文的这个 brief， 所以我就简单说一下我在这期节目里面的一些收获。那么首先 Braden 他是非常有意思啊，他在1995年在他十岁的时候就开始做了自己的第一次创业，就是当时呢就买了他的家里面有一台 PC， 然后就开始学习怎么去写 HTML， 然后就拿那个黄页啊，就翻着电话去给企业打电话，说能不能给他们提供服务。后面呢发传真什么的，后面呢这个行为就被他的叔父就他的爷爷就制止了，因为爷爷收到了这个电话账单和这个传真的这个账单，被吓晕了，所以就停下来了。然后后面他又开始15岁的时候又开始创业，又开始做自己的生意，所以是一个非常有生意头脑的，然后非常有行动力的这样的一个人。然后后面呢开始这个进入agency， 也就是我们经常说的这个广告界吧，设计界。那么开始做自己的职业发展，然后也经历了不同的公司等等。那么在10年前开始创业，做自己的这个agency， 叫做 Space in Between， 这个夹缝空间可以这么翻译。那么开始做自己的 agency。 那么在今年的时候呢，他开始对自己的 agency 做了一个转型，也就是投入到如何去做用户的 research， 用户调研，用户的访谈然后呢他们在自己的这个空间呢做了一个新西兰目前来说最专业的顶尖的这个用户测试实验室User Research Lab。 那么在这个实验室里面呢，可以做这个用户 usability testing， 然后呢也可以做这个远程的这种互动调研访谈，非常棒。以后如果有机会的话，可能会做一期这个视频的节目来介绍一下这个 usability Space in Between User Research Lab。 那么这个是其中一点。然后其中我们也提到了说，新西兰其实在设计或者说在技术领域呢，它和其他国家相比有一定的差距。那么 可能是因为地理的其他等等的原因，新西兰人喜欢用一些这个 DIY 的方式解决问题。像我们经常会说，会用这个，怎么说呢，就是这个八号铁丝的这个方式来解决问题。这是新西兰 Kiwi 经常说的一句话，就是八号铁丝是一种，什么地方都可以买得到的这个日常用品啊，这个劳保运用品。然后呢，新西兰人车坏了 ，OK， 没问题，我用八号铁丝，车轮子掉了，我用八号铁丝绑一下可以开。然后门坏了啊，我用八号铁丝捆一下可以开。这个栅栏，这个栏杆坏了，或者是这个其他的这个铁什么地方的网没了，然后呢，这个我用八号铁丝做一个围栏，做一个网兜 ，OK， 又可以用了。所以这也是用来形容说新西兰人DIY 能力很强，但换一个角度也是用来说新西兰人很不在意说用一些最好的方式来解决，而是用一个马上就可以实用的这个方式来解决。但是这个方面我觉得咱们中国人应该是更有这方面的发言权啊，就是我们更擅长于说用一个比较灵活的方式来解决问题。所以我在这期节目也和 Braden 讨论了这个话题，就是如何面对在现在因为新冠疫情的这个原因呢，让全世界拉到了同一个起跑线，开始面对相同的竞争。其实对于新西兰人来说，这个竞争比咱们国内的同行或者是这个技术界的人来说呢，感受会更明显一些，因为都是英文国家嘛，就是他可能现在就要面对和加拿大、澳大利亚、美国、英国这样的一些市场的直接竞争。那么以前呢只是作为他们的市场，那么现在呢可能也会作为他们的输入方啊输出方。那么讨论了这样的一些话题，那么最后还是沉淀到个人，就是我们作为个人来说如何去提升自己来面对，因为这也是我很想讨论的一个话题。那么Braden 呢，他的建议就是说和我的一些想法是非常相似的，就是说设计是一个练习，是一个实践性的一个工作啊， design is a practice， 所以呢就意味着你必须多做一些实战，多做一些练习，然后尽量的积累自己的经验，同时呢面对挑战。 OK， 那么这就是这一期和 Braden 聊我们在这个新冠疫情的时代八号铁丝如何面对更好的未来。 OK， 可能这就是这一期的标题吧，八号铁丝如何面对更好的未来。 Anyway， 如果你喜欢的话记得点一下赞，然后记得去关注狗熊有话说的播客留言这就是对我的支持。 OK， 然后这期节目还是英文的啊，如果觉得有困难的话呢请留言注明，那么后面也请关注其他的一些不是英文访谈的其他主题节目。谢谢你收听我们下期再见咯，拜拜。请继续收听哦，继续收听接下来是英文版的内容。 OK， Hello and welcome to Bear Academy. I'm Bear. This week I met a UX entrepreneerAn agency founder in New Zealand, in Auckland. So this guy, Brandon Jarvis, he founded the best UX research lab here in the country. We talked a lot of things around UX, around design, around how Kiwi can better cope with the new norm and get ready for the digital challenge ahead of us. And also, on the down to the ground level, how we as individuals can get ready for the new age, and how we can deliver, how we can develop ourselves to be a better designer. Yeah, a lot of heaps of great insights from this episode. Let's jump into it. Could you introduce yourself a little bit at first? It's just a basic introduction for yourself.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Brendan Jarvis and I'm the managing founder of The Space In Between. And the space in between is a specialist UX research practice and also the home to New Zealand's first and only world-class UX lab.
Right. That's a very clear and understandable description. And I just want to jump directly to the things I found. The most interesting thing about you, what I found, is that you started your own business at 10. In 1995, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's going back a while. Yeah.
How about start with this story?
Yeah, sure. So at that time, I was fortunate enough to grow up next to my grandparents. And they were very, very generous people. Yeah. And they had purchased a PC, the first PC that I think anyone in our extended family had seen at that time. Because at that time they were, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 just for a very basic computer. And I ended up spending more and more time over there. I was so curious about this this thing, the computer, and it really captivated me. And about the same time as they bought the computer, they also got an internet connection.
Wow.
And I started learning through various websites how to code HTML.
At that time? People just start and learn like basic or other like language about coding, but you jump directly to HTML.
Yeah, I can't remember how exactly I found my way to it, but like I said, I was very curious, and there's a reason why I'm so pasty white. I've spent so much time in front of screens in my life, it's quite scary. Yeah. So I ended up teaching myself the basics of it, and I thought what would be really great is if I could get some clients. And what I ended up doing is going through the Yellow Pages at that time, which was a telephone directory that we had of businesses in New Zealand. And I wrote them a letter by hand, and I faxed these letters, these sales letters, pitching myself as a website design service to these businesses. And I think it probably only lasted a couple of weeks. I probably sent 20 or 30 of these, and then I remember my grandfather being very grumpy one day, and I asked him what was going on, and he's received the telephone bill. Because back then sending faxes wasn't free, and that was the end of that business. So there were no clients, but there was a determination.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a drop one of your business. But
failed business.
But I think that's a lot of great points that I can found from this story. The first is that it's quite unique for your family can invest a PC and internet at that time. Because this feels like people not probably invest something, a TV or other things, or larger cars. So things like that. I think that's a really different way so it can get a better position for you and really open the eyes. And especially PC and internet is really expensive. Was really expensive at that time.
Like I mentioned, my grandparents were very generous people and they had a large family. And they were blue collar background, so I was the first person in my family, my extended family. I'm talking five children that my grandparents had, my aunties and uncles, and all of their children, some of which have also gone on to university. But I was the first person to receive a university degree in my extended family. Mm. And I suppose why I'm saying that is a lot of that had to do with the willingness and generosity of my grandparents to invest in things that they felt would help us to better further ourselves and better educate ourselves. They were spectacular people.
Yeah. And also, the other thing I feel quite impressive is that you jump not only on HTML, that's another story, but you jump directly to business. So a lot of people, from my understanding, probably at the beginning of learning something, with just how I can do better or what is the skills and knowledges I need to learn. But it's quite different that for you, you jump directly into business even when you are only 10 at that time.
I suppose it has to do with, you know, I want to, I suppose, make this clear. I didn't go without anything. I had a very loving extended family, but I grew up as a only child, and my mum was a solo mum, and I certainly saw the more difficult side of life when you don't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I suppose that was an early influence in how I felt about myself and what I wanted to achieve with my life from very early age.
Mm.
And I suppose the business actually had its roots a couple of years earlier. I remember going to primary school. I was 8. I think it was Standard 2, they called it back in the day. And my teacher had asked me one morning before class started, you know, what did I want to be when I grew up? You know, this sort of quintessential question that you ask a child.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't say what. I said who. I said, I want to be Bill Gates.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. I suppose I've been captivated by, you know, the computer world. And of course, at that time, Bill Gates was, and still is, I suppose, one of the preeminent figures in that revolution.
Right.
And yeah. It was a very exciting time for a young person.
Yeah. Wow. How about what's the next business attempt after that?
So the next business attempt was, I was very fortunate at around about the age of 15. I had a close family friend who had always, I suppose, seen that I was maybe a little bit different than some other people, you know, starting businesses at 10. And I was a very curious child and really loved technology. And he and some other pharmacists had started one of the first online pharmacies in the country.
Mm.
That was called Medicine Express. And he had realized that I'd developed some capability in the area of programming. I'd been building websites for my Quake clan, which was a computer game back in the day, and
yeah.
I'd been doing, you know, hobbyist type work. And he, as I said, they were launching this online pharmacy, and he gave me a great opportunity to basically design and build and market this pharmacy for them. And rather than pay me a wage and employ me, what they said to me is that they would pay me per order that came in, a certain amount of money. And so that was, I suppose, a very early, but this time profitable start to running a business with the right incentives. It was just me still at that stage, but I was being paid based on the performance I could deliver as opposed to the time that I was investing. So that was the next business. And that actually ended up being a place that I worked and managed until I finished university, and they sold that business.
Sounds like a quite successful one.
Yeah.
Lasted for a long time.
Yeah, well, it certainly helped. I didn't have to work at the supermarket anymore, and I was able to control my time more because I was able to leverage my expertise at that early age into something that was, you know, relatively profitable for that stage of life. And it gave me a great start and a good story to tell when I finished university and was in the job market.
Right.
But I don't like to tell people that I was effectively an online drug dealer. That sort of raises a few eyebrows, but I can say for certain that they were all
just
above board. It was all above board. There were no illegal drugs. It was all legitimate pharmacy. But yes, it was an export-focused business, and it was a lot of fun.
Right, because my first job in New Zealand was work at a health supplement company, online. So it's kind of like the same. People, some of my friends ask, who are you working on? I said, drug dealer.
Yeah.
So drugs on my table every day, things like that. It's quite interesting. And it's really impressive that at the beginning of your study and it's quite different from other people's career plan or strategy, because probably other, I don't know, maybe for a general Kiwi at the beginning working supermarket or some place and then go to university and find a job, maybe a permanent role or some work for some companies, and started and after a few years invest a house and then move on to his or her own business, or probably just stay in that industry and jump to different companies, and that's all. So how about you? What's the roadmap and what's the career path for that and finally got you here?
Yeah, so I mean, it hasn't all been a success story. After finishing university, I decided I was going to start a proper business this time. Mm-hmm. And I went into business with someone who was a bit more experienced and had an established business. And we wanted to effectively do web design. That was the simple way of describing it. And
have you considered to join a company at the beginning or just not an option for you?
Yeah, I remember in the last year or end of the second year of university that, you know, people around you start thinking about which companies they're going to go and work for when they finish their undergraduate, and there's the graduate programs that all the consultancies and other businesses that come into the business school, because I studied e-commerce and business in Victoria. Mm-hmm. So there was that path, but I never wanted to go down that path. I always wanted to have control over how I spent my time, and I wanted to live, I suppose, with more risk than maybe other people were willing to live with. I don't know if I saw it that way at the time. I think I was just rather excited by the possibilities that were presented by running your own company. But in the end, I suppose I went to this to start this business with this other guy, and I learned a couple of hard lessons. One lesson I learned was be very careful with who you go into business with, because what appears at face value is not always the case. And the other lesson that I learned is that I would have probably made more money if I was on the benefit for the 1 year that I was in that business. It was not successful. It was very poor in terms of its financial performance, and it was ultimately after 12 months I decided, because of the relationship that I'd had with this other person deteriorating and the poor financial performance of the endeavor, that I would I suppose take a step into the real world and go and get a real job, which I did, and I went to work for a design agency in Wellington.
Right. I think it sounds like a really common experience for business starters to choose the right people to work with. Because I have the similar experience when I started my company in China. The first partner was a very close friend, and at that time I didn't know too much about that, and just think, we play together very good. So now we can work together, but things doesn't go that way. And then even the friendship doesn't go that way after that. So it's quite a shame. I think that's a lot of people mentioned that, but I think probably even when you are experiencing, like have the actual experience, you will find it, understand. Yeah, that's the kind of like a hard lesson to learn. But
there's only one way to learn that
Do it.
You just do it. And it is unfortunate because often those friendships don't survive. And it's the price that you pay. My observation of these situations has been that even when it's not a lot of money, when there's money involved, it really changes the dynamic between two people. It doesn't always. I suppose it increases the risk that dynamic changes negatively between two people. And I don't think there's any... I'm not sure I'm experienced enough to say that there are any strategies to try and avoid that. But what I do know is a good idea, because it's happened more than once. Actually, in the space in between, I had a business partner who became a good friend and then exited the company after, I think, 3 years. And one thing that we did that made it easier to have that conversation, although it was still difficult, was that we had a shareholders agreement that was quite clear about how things would happen if someone wanted to leave the company, what the process would be in terms of valuation and how it would run. But those human relationships, even though you might be well planned, sometimes don't survive that process, which is a shame.
But I think you mentioned that it's at first a business partner and then become a very good friend. That's the that's a better sequence rather than be a friend first and business partner and then stranger at last.
So, well, you stand to lose more, I suppose, if it's a friend first.
Yeah,
you know, because you know what right. you had before.
Yeah. And you mentioned that then you went to a design agency because I read your articles, your interviews, and you said that some people, probably your previous employer or someone, mm-hmm. said you don't fit this advertisement industry. Is that something that you can share? Like, what's that experience?
So after working for the design agency in Wellington for a couple of years, I got the opportunity to come up to Auckland and start their office up here. Mm. And that was all great. That was a fantastic opportunity. I think I was 21 or 2 at the time.
Wow.
Managed to convince them to give me the title General Manager, which I thought was very impressive.
Yeah.
Gave myself a bit of a self high five for that one. But it was a great time, great opportunity. I had a lovely team up here. And then the Great recession hit in 2008, and it became very, very, very difficult. So I ended up leaving the design agency and getting this opportunity in another business. Mm. And I was only there for 3 months, so you might be able to sort of read between the lines and see how well that went.
Right.
And I remember
it was a mistake.
I think it was maybe a mistake on both parties' ends. But I remember being in the boardroom, and it was one of those meetings. I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but sometimes you have these meetings and there's only ever going to be one way that they're going to play out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a good meeting as far as I was concerned from my perspective. Yeah. And I got sat down basically, and I would politely describe it as a character assassination. I got a blow by blow of basically all of my shortcomings, which culminated with a statement that was, I don't think that you're in the right industry.
Oh, no.
Yeah, oh, no.
Meeting.
Yeah, it was a very hard meeting. Actually, I remember leaving that day, and I don't mind saying this, that I think I cried in my car. I'd never had anyone say anything so cutting to the bone about my abilities. And not because I lived in some sort of cotton wool environment where I was told my whole life how wonderful I was. I was quite aware that I had some shortcomings, but I've never really had anyone try and put the knife in quite so deep, and no one has ever done that to me since. But it wasn't something that I look at and I think, oh, it was a horrible thing to do to somebody, but it wasn't a bad thing to have happened to me, because I basically used that in a large part to give myself the motivation to, I suppose, prove that that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Not to that person in particular, but just I knew he was wrong,
mm-hmm.
And it was now time to really make that happen.
Yeah.
So then I started the space in between.
Wow, I think sometimes we just need kind of the external motivation, and sometimes a challenge will make us stronger.
Mm.
It depends on different people, but in general, I do find that should be motivated by something, and this type of the statement, you know, that's kind of the one of the things that we really want to fight back and to show what we are able to do, and to prove them wrong. And I think at this stage, probably without this meeting, there will be no space in between.
That's right, and that's why I look at that, and I think, you know, you could look at that, and I could have been crushed by it, and it could have ruined my confidence.
Right.
But if someone ever says something like that to you, I think it's really important that you live in how much that hurts for the moment, but that you get some perspective on that, and you realize that just because somebody else is saying that about you does not make it true. You know, you are the author of your own story, and you get to decide what's written on the next page.
Right.
And don't let anybody hold the pen for you. It's really important that you write the book yourself.
So
I think it ultimately was a very positive thing. It reaffirmed a few self-beliefs that I held.
One thing I find probably quite interesting. I don't know if it's only me or from other people, because you mentioned that this one, this harsh meeting happened in advertisement industry. Because I also heard some other stories related or similar experience, like other designers find working advertisement, especially agency companies, are quite challenging because they don't know, they don't have the a lot of touch points with clients or with the customers or users, but only probably one person, like the art director or the creative director, will make the decision if it's okay, yes or no. So do you have any like any related insights or stories around this? Because what I've used to work at in China is kind of like similar, but I don't know from here, like New Zealand, what like from the especially like the traditional creative industry, how it looks and how it works.
Yeah,
from agency's perspective.
So what you have just talked about reminds me of a recent conversation I had with a gentleman called Dr. David Travis. And David is a really highly esteemed usability and user researcher in the UK. And what he said to me was that good design doesn't live inside designers. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because that doesn't sound like a very good thing to say in design circles. You know, most designers probably think, what do you mean good design doesn't live inside me? I'm the designer. And what I'm getting at is there's this attitude, I suppose, in traditional creative industries and even in design in general and digital design and creative people in general, that they are the source of the creativity. But I think when it comes to the design of experiences or products or services that other humans engage with, which, let's face it, is most of the work that we now do, particularly in the digital industry, that the good design or the great design is actually found in the space that the user is interacting with whatever you've created. And it's in that space that you can get the insights that you can then go back and apply and refine your design with that will actually make it great. And without that input, if you're just operating in a vacuum, you're caught up in your own ego and you're not willing to be brave and to put that in front of someone else that it's designed for to use it, it's very difficult or hard to see that you could ever be wildly successful in your craft.
Yeah, that's a great point, because it's, from my understanding, it feels like a designer's value or the design's value is evaluated by the customer's experience, and it's really some kind of, you know, we don't have a very clear measurement for taking the data accurate to measure how it performs, how it works. And yeah, that's really an interesting point. But I think at this stage, the modern design trends or the how we do it now, it's much better than it used to be. Because before that, it's like a black box. Everyone's doing their own work and then do a presentation and show, here's the thing.
Yeah.
And people don't, I like it, or it's, I don't like it, and then go back and work for another few weeks. But now, like, we're working design sprint, agile, and things like that, so we try to validate things in the day-to-day basis. So this is some things that we're trying, as a designer or in design industry, is trying to convince that this is the right way to do that, or this is a proper way to do that. And I think a lot of designers now not afraid of show things in the process. And before that, probably people still think, yeah, I'm not ready for showing this and not ready to discuss the things in process, because it's still not finished.
Mm.
But yeah, now I think if you can have the right understanding of the design thinking methodology and all the things, and it's not a problem. It's all right. You say no, and you let people know it's not the final version, and there will be an iteration, continuous improving. But as long as the other guy understand value. So yeah, I think that's something we're trying to improve or still on the way. That's what I'm trying to, that's what I'm interested in about, like what it used to be.
Yeah, well, what it used to be was more of a battle of opinions. And there is still an element of that goes on. And I think it's encouraging that there is more of an openness, though, to settling those opinions by saying, okay, great, we might have a difference of opinion here, but let's both be adults about this. Let's de-risk the situation and determine what might be the right way forward, which may be neither of the opinions that we hold, quite frankly. It could be a third opinion or a third perspective that we haven't heard, and that's to actually put it to the test with the customer.
Right.
And that, to me, is a real sign of, and I don't really like this term maturity, but for lack of a better word, that it's a real sign of a maturity of an organization when they're willing to hold those opinions loosely and they're willing to settle the disputes, if you like, by actually testing that with real users.
Yeah, that's actually a quite good point to relate here to what I just saw, like the user testing room and the lab you just showed me. For the people who's listening, probably can't see it, but I just saw the world class interviewing room, and it's here at a space in between. And I think it's a great way that can show people, rather than the opinions, show some data and show some statistics about the performance. So it's not just an opinions war. And it's quite common for a lot of companies that if you show a design to different stakeholders, so like different team members, and normally senior stakeholders' opinion probably gonna win. And even there are bias, or there are some it's not on the same perspective with the customer, and they always win. But now I think if we as a designer can have the better way to defend our design, that would be great. So it's just reminded me that what I just saw about your lab, so which is quite impressive. Could you tell us a little bit more about this? I know it's jumping a little bit fast, but
wanted
to know that. Yeah.
So the lab is, it's not a new idea, but I feel it is a very important expression of a commitment to being user-centered. And what it is it's a place where we can bring a design team and anybody else in the organization that has an interest in the design, so whether it's a new feature or a new product, or whether we're just trying to assess a competitor and learn a bit more about their user experience, where we can bring them into a space, and in that same space can be some real live users, not abstractions, not analytics data, not personas that may or may not be relevant, but actual people that reflect the user that you're trying to design for, trying to create products and services for. And while there is an analytical aspect of what we can measure when we have the user in this setting, what we're actually trying to do is learn through observation of their behavior how they are experiencing the product, the feature that we are trying to learn more about. And generally what we do is we give the user a series of scenarios or tasks that reflect some form of real world behavior that they would otherwise be performing. And we ask them to complete those tasks. And we look, and we listen, and we learn, and we find where the problems are, and we keep our mind open as to what the opportunities might be to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I found that just a really great way that can collect insights from those observations. And some companies, organizations, they probably have their own design team and already do the same thing. And what do you think could be the advantage from space in between, like to do that and to provide those kind of the research? What's the difference between the in-house design team and another agency to do that?
Yeah. So when it comes to in-house design teams, I have always seen what I'm trying to achieve here as being very much their ally.
Right.
So this is a place and an experience and a service that actually helps that internal design team to do a couple of things. It helps them to more easily scale and reliably repeat their efforts to understand their users because of the nature of this purpose-built facility and what it enables. Sometimes you find in a design team internally they might just be overwhelmed and they need some extra capacity. Other times you might find that there's very talented people in there, but the organization hasn't yet seen the light when it comes to providing them with the space to actually run the kind of research that's going to make a difference in their design. So there's that aspect of what this enables for the design team. And the other thing that it enables is it's outside of the building. This is a place that exists outside of the organization.
It's a neutral place.
It's a neutral place.
Yeah.
It doesn't suffer from any of the politics of who owns the lab inside. You know, can I trust that the perspective that I'm getting back from whoever isn't biased by a particular opinion that is held? But it's also more than that. It's a place that is designed to raise the credibility and the esteem of our practice as designers, and particularly UX. And we can invite people from across the business to participate in the design process in this beautiful world-class setting. And it's that kind of ability to help change the conversation inside the company that really sits underneath all of the very important research and UX work that we do here with teams. But it's really ultimately I'm trying to change the design culture in New Zealand and give designers another way that they can help to further that cause.
Right, yeah. Because what I know is that a lot of companies, they have the probably have the user testing setup or environment, but some of them was driven by from marketing perspective. It's not from UX perspective. And sometimes it's also like what you mentioned, it's not a neutral place. Even the setup is perfect. If you go to a company's office as a customer to do the user testing, and more or less you got some inception from about your mind, and probably there will be some bias even before the testing. So I think that would be great as a neutral place.
And we can hand on heart say to participants when they come in, we didn't have anything to do with the design of what it is that you're going to see today. You know, we can really honestly say that. And the other thing that we can say is that we don't have a horse in the race when it comes to the design or the development of this product either. So to our clients, we are only focused on helping you to see the user's truth. That's it. We're not there to try and sell you other services. We're completely impartial, completely independent. And we're giving you the truth of that user.
Do you have any story or any case study or any story related to the user testing here? Is there something that can go public or something you can share?
Eventually there will be. There's nothing that I can speak about at the moment. Being research, it's quite difficult to talk candidly about some of the things that we've been involved with. What I can tell you that has been really exciting and I can talk about publicly is we've formed a relationship with Tech Futures Lab.
Right.
And we've had several of their short course, product management groups through. Right. And it's been so great seeing people that come from various different corporate backgrounds, whether it's accounting and finance or whether it's people that have worked in marketing, and bringing them into a space like this and having them with each other evaluate the prototypes that they have been creating as part of their work that they've been doing at Tech Futures Lab. And it's a really fun evening and really eye-opening. I think everyone that comes in here just immediately gets the value of usability testing. User testing. And it's not really about selling them as such. I think it's just you might hear about this stuff and it might live in, you know, some corner office in the organization, or it might be perceived to be part of just the design team or maybe just one person's role. But I think until you actually come to a place like this and you see it happening, it's difficult to really grasp just how useful it can be.
Right. I would definitely book another session for this podcast interview, like when it, when some case is ready for share. And definitely want to hear some behind scene stories. And what I can imagine, like if I'm a design manager, it will be great to collaborate with this facilitation and then show the value to other stakeholders, and then can let them understand what's the value and how it works, and then even later stage, it's not exactly what. Like what you're doing at here, they can still get a better process for the their own companies. So things like that, that just came to my mind, and it's really really interesting to see. What another thing came to my mind is that from the book Lean UX, the author mentioned rapidly or general user interview, like every week invite 3 customers, real customers, go to the office and have a conversation with the team, and probably if the product has new features, do some user testing. If not, just talk with them and understand their behavior and collect some data from that, and which would be great to create a better persona. But something is really valuable is to by talking with them, the whole team can understand the customer better.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
So that's something I'm thinking, like it could be some other types of the of the package that you can provide for different customers, different companies.
That cadence that you've touched on there, that sort of repetition of involving the user in the process, whether it's just conversation and discovery based interview, or whether it's to assess something that you've produced and try and get their behavior and their perspective on it, that's really important. And that is something that actually develops, like when you go to the gym, you know, you first start out, you can only, you know, do 10 push-ups, but if you keep going back every day, you know, you soon find that you can do 100. It's a muscle that gets stronger,
right.
And the only way it gets stronger and the only way that you're going to get better insights and create better products is to be regularly and reliably running these studies and these types of conversations. Otherwise it's too late, too little in the process, and it's too hard to adjust a design when everyone just wants to celebrate it going live. No one wants to hear bad news right at the end. So doing it on the way through, even doing your explorative research before you've even decided what it is that you're going to build. You need to be doing it, and you probably aren't doing as much as you could do.
Right. That's a good point. And also, like, the location is quite good. It's in the center of the city. So because we talk things about the space in between. Now, it's not from my understanding, it's a UX lab, but before that, you also work for different clients, like provide a UX solution, design solution for them.
That's right. Yeah. We've been doing that for 10 years. And I suppose that's what gives us the capability and the credibility to apply the research methods that we were using as part of our own design practice,
right.
And then only focus on applying those parts of what we were doing for our clients now. that we have been successful practitioners of design in the field that we are now advising on the insights to inform designers, other designers, to make better decisions.
It might not be a proper question, but I really want to ask is that, do you think it's because the design is so easy to be judged by individual level, and also like from your agency experience, you already work in this industry for more than 10 years, and so why do you think it would be the good strategy to build a research focused company? Is it because you feel it's a better way to back the design, or like it's a better strategy for the clients or for your business? I'm not sure if I describe my question clearly, but
I think I understand what you're asking. So I suppose I looked at what it was that was most enjoyable out of the design process, and what was the hardest part. And the hardest part and the most enjoyable part is always the part when you put your work in front of a real life user and you see what happens. And often it's not what you expected, and sometimes it's not what you would have liked. And that experience is a really valuable experience. And I looked at how we were running those experiences and thought about, well, is that the greatest impact that we can have if we just keep that inside our own design practice, or is this something that actually needs to be, you know, let out of the cage and something that we can help a wider set of designers to do better, to make better decisions? And I decided that that really was the most interesting, the most valuable thing that we could do. And I looked at what else we were doing and realized that it would be very difficult for us to honestly say that we are going to do the research and insights part of a project without any bias if we were also selling, if you like, for that terrible word, selling the design implementation, whether that's the UX and the UI, or whether it's on the other end of it, the development, that there was an inherent bias in the solution and the things that we might recommend, or the things that we might leave out, even if we are doing our best to step away and be impartial. It's almost like having the student mark their own exam. There's always the risk that they just might not do it 100% above board. And I didn't want to carry that bias through to this next phase of what it is that we're doing. So we will never work on anything that we've been involved in or have been asked to be involved in any of the implementation. Only focused on the insights, and that way we can be truly independent.
That's a really clever strategy, and also like necessary for all the clients and all the potential customers.
You know, I suppose also generally, if you look at the industry, I mean, how many design agencies are there? I mean, how many? I mean, there are just so many, and everybody generally says that we can do everything. And I just don't. I know that. I mean, I've made those kind of claims, you know, in the past. We're full service, whatever that means. You know, it often means nothing in reality, and there are very few companies in this country that can truly say that they are full service. So you look at the credibility that sits behind a lot of the messaging that's out there in the marketplace, and the truth is people are spreading themselves too thin, and each of these things, and you know, whether it's UI, UX, UX research, development, they're all massive specialties in and of themselves, but for whatever reason in New Zealand we have this tendency to avoid specialization, to overly generalize, and I think ultimately that reflects poorly in a lot of businesses' positioning. They're just not meaningful. You know, it's very difficult, unless you've got massive scale, to command any attention if you're saying that you do everything.
So always specialist rather than generalist.
That's definitely the direction that we've adopted. And, I mean, that allows us to build deep expertise. You know, things like that will really be able to stand up and make a big difference in a client's business rather than just coming up with some fancy words and, you know, the whole fake it till you make it sort of approach that some companies take with their clients' money is just almost criminal. You know, it's a very dangerous way and a very poor way for the client to experience the result.
Do you think New Zealand is ready for this? I came to New Zealand around 4 years, and I think as people here really nice and really ready to adapt new things. But from the company's level, is it a mature market that get ready to to hire specialists rather than generalists?
I think we're right on the cusp. Yeah. But I've got a horse in this race as well, so I almost have to believe that we're ready.
Yeah. Leap of faith.
And in all business or all significant change in business, there is a certain leap of faith. From what I have experienced so far in the marketplace since making this big shift, I'm very encouraged by the change that I've made. But it's too early to say. I can't see the future, but I'm very, very encouraged.
And the other thing, what I'm thinking is that the pandemic, COVID thing, actually accelerated the whole world, especially for New Zealand, to be ready for the competition all around the world. And before that, maybe it's not a problem. Like we, as a local market, even everyone speaking English the same as Canada and US, but it's a totally different market, and you don't need to compete with other market. In the individual level, it's the same. In the company's level, it's the same. But now it's different, because now people get used to collaborate or like work remotely. With that, internationally, it's not an issue.
Yeah.
And also, the competition could be from other major market, like the other part of the world. And we don't need to talk about different languages market, but just on English speaking market is still quite different. And if we are ready, so for that perspective, like be a specialist will be focused on your like the specific area that you're really good at would be a better strategy. Like I can do all the things and I can be ready for all the like a full stack or full service, like what you mentioned. Probably that would be a better strategy, that focus on one thing rather than other than.
Have you heard of the saying number eight wire?
Is it a wild, like a...
The fencing wire?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's used as an analogy for New Zealand's historical approach to innovation.
Everything is just to make it.
We can make it up with a bit of number eight wire.
Yeah.
And it's a really harmful myth. It's... It's really done us a disservice in the last 20 to 30 years to carry that myth with us, because ultimately what it's meant is that we've underinvested in the facilities, the capabilities and the people to really help us keep up with the pace of competition globally.
Yeah.
We're quite an insular nation and we're an island nation, and so by our geography, sometimes our perspective is too close to home and needs to be further abroad. And really for the next 100 years, we need to start looking more openly at how business is done internationally and actively starting, perhaps like China has done in the last 20 to 30 years, taking what is valuable, the learnings that we can see from overseas, and really applying them back to our own context with purpose, so that we can actually better defend and grow our own prosperity, because change is coming. Change is already here. You know, what happens when Amazon decides to open up in New Zealand? You know, what is the game plan? You know, IKEA is on its way. I mean, I know I'm talking retail here, but there are other examples. The internet has removed a lot of the geographical boundaries that used to protect certain industries.
Mm.
And I think any industry, there are no industries that I can think of off the top of my head that should be feeling really smug and comfortable about what the next 20, 30, 40 years brings.
Mm.
So it's important that we start building our capabilities and our capacities to respond more effectively to innovation and to actually start investing.
Yeah.
Seriously investing in ourselves and not trying to do everything on the cheap.
Mm.
And I feel that we use number eight wire sometimes to justify underinvesting in our people and also in our facilities and capabilities.
Yeah, number eight wire. That's a good, and four. I want to bring the last two questions down the ground level because there are a lot of things on the business and a lot of people listening to this podcast probably are going to work as a professional, maybe as a designer or other types of professional in their own career. So would you have some suggestion or advice, like for example, like in the junior or in the early stage of a designer's career, if you're going to provide some suggestion or guidance, like what would you suggest that for junior professionals, maybe not just designers, professionals, and here in New Zealand, I think we can still focus on this, and then
So I love talking to younger people about their futures. In fact, they often start talking to me about their futures, and the one thing that I always say to them is stop talking about it, start taking massive action. You have to commit to a certain direction. You have to stop worrying about whether it's the right direction or the wrong direction, because the truth is, if you never ever step through that door, you'll never know. And don't try and hold all of your options open, because it will leave you not taking any direction that is meaningful. So you need to take action. You need to walk through one of these opportunities in front of you and just give it everything. Focus.
That's a great suggestion.
And if you don't enjoy it, that's fine. You will have learned something from it. You will have worked hard. And there's another door that you'll be able to walk through. But just get started and take lots of action.
Right.
And don't live in the 9-to-5 mentality. I'm not saying you have to be a slave to your boss or anything like that. That's a horrible way to spend your life. But if you truly love what you do, the standard work day or work week won't apply. And nothing great happens without massive amounts of action, and that doesn't happen within 40 hours.
Right. Actually, that's related to my next question, but it's great to hear that I prefer them to not only work, not only focus the energy on 9-to-5, but also invest some time on and effort on the things they love to do.
Because what I'm saying there is that you are investing in yourself.
Right, yeah.
So while you might work for someone else, and there's nothing wrong with that, most people in the world, 99% of people in the world work for someone else, you are always working for yourself. So that time that you invest in yourself after work and whatever it is that you enjoy or that you're interested in, you are investing in your future. And it's important to see it with the long-term perspective and not just the what am I getting out of this today, because that is not how prosperous lives are built. It's built with a longer term view.
That's great. First, you are the expert in UX field here. Do you have any career suggestion for someone? Because a lot of people reach out to me, like they would like to become a UX designer. Sometimes they would like to transition from another career path, or just as the graduate, just would like to start their own career as a UX designer. And I'm sure that you have some
suggestion from your perspective and also from your understanding of the market of the career. Do you have any, like, go to design school or just join a company or something like that, read books?
Well, they call design a practice, and it's called a practice for a very good reason, because you get better at it the more practice you do. So the most important thing if someone wants to become a UX designer is to stop wanting to become a UX designer and start doing UX design. Because design is something that you do, and you only become it once you do it. And a good example I can think of is Charles, actually, who's working here, who's finishing up shortly, which is very sad for me, but going to a great opportunity. Charles, before he became a UX and UI designer, invested a lot of effort in putting up his own work on Dribbble and Behance that he was working on in his own time.
Right.
I mean, yes, he invested in his formal education, but he went the extra mile after the 9-to-5 and applied what he was trying to teach himself to design challenges that weren't commercial projects. So do the design work. It's a doing thing, it's a practice. Don't think about it too much, just start doing it. And you will suck initially, and the only way that you get better is to keep on doing it.
That actually reminded me an article or like another podcast that I recently consumed, is that as a practice, like design, it's the same as other practice that work out or do a pottery or anything like that. The first 100 pieces of work will be suck. So don't worry about that. Your purpose is to go to the process and get the first 100 the pieces as soon as possible. And if you move to the next stage, this is the first stage.
That's
you
right.
definitely need to practice a lot and make mistakes.
I mean, I look at work that we did even 3 or 4 years ago, some of it, and I think, oh man, we could have done that so much better. But at the time, it probably was great. We thought it was great. It probably was great. But you get better at things, and therefore you see the shortcomings in your previous work. But that's progress that is telling you that you are getting better.
I think that's great, and just keep practice, and doesn't matter like some specific strategy approaches, books or talking to people, but practice is the general like the core of design.
In fact, Seth Godin, who some of you may have heard of, he is a blogger, marketer, author, speaker, very, very inspirational individual. He's just released a book called The Practice, which was essentially all about what we're talking about as creative people, as you need to engage in your practice.
Because especially I found from some even junior professionals, they are afraid of make mistakes, and their defense is that I'm a professionalist, so when I find my work is not perfect, I prefer not to do it. So that's kind of like, I think it's just an excuse or some kind of a mindset, because they haven't go through the whole process and doesn't have the understanding of that. But
Look, I've got an almost 2.5-year-old son, and watching him try and fail and try and fail and try and fail. This is what growing up is. It is a series of minor failures in quick succession. But the other side of that is it's a series of minor successes in quick succession. And at some point along the way, the world tells us that we suck at something or that we can't do it perfectly, and we start to care more about what other people think than what we actually think. And our education system, the way that we assess people and the types of things that we I suppose put in people's children's heads for 15 years or more before they come out of a formal education setting into a job, tells them and teaches them to be very risk averse. because who wants to be wrong and who wants to be made fun of for being wrong? You know, we're very binary and black and white in the way that we assess educational achievement, and that does have an impact on how children view the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of that mentality that you're observing in people that are junior designers is coming from conditioning that they received in our education system. So that's probably a bit beyond the scope of the podcast, but it's definitely part of the problem, and it's something that we also need to reinvent and redesign.
Right.
Is how we're educating people.
Because all
that stuff just gets in the way of great design, right? It's just all noise.
Right.
Yeah. Like, if you never try, how on earth are you ever going to be great at something?
We can book another session. thank you, Brendan. That's a great, lot of insights I've got, and I believe people who's listening can get a lot. And if they have anything would like to know more, your website would be the best way.
You can find me at thespaceinbetween.co.nz or on LinkedIn, Brendan Jarvis. That's BRENDANJARVIS. And on Twitter at the same, Brendan Jarvis.
Right. Cool. Thank you, Brendan. That's really, really great to have you here.
Great to be here. Yeah. Thanks, Bear.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode. Cheers. Bye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.